This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, July 10th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, as Congress pushes for a cybersecurity law to allow corporations and the government to share more information, privacy advocates warn of increased domestic spying. Parliament members meet in Egypt, defying the military council and raising questions about a court's ruling under the new president. And we'll go to Turkey, where a controversial court system is trying journalists, academics, and activists accused of aiding a terrorist group. Critics call it a way to suppress dissent. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. The International Criminal Court sentenced Congolese warlord Thomas Lubanga to 14 years in prison today. Lubanga was convicted in March of recruiting and using child soldiers in his rebel group, the Union of Congolese Patriots, or UPC, between 2002 and 2003. Judges at the ICC said it was not possible to establish the number of children recruited as soldiers, but that the practice was widespread. Presiding Judge Adrian Fulford.
The crimes of conscripting and enlisting children under the age of 15 and using them to participate actively in hostilities are undoubtedly very serious crimes. The crime of using children to participate actively in hostilities involves exposing them to real danger as potential targets. The vulnerability of children means that they need to be afforded particular protection that does not apply to the general population.
The Lubanga sentence is the first ever handed down at the 10-year-old ICC. Human rights advocates criticized the court for not charging Lubanga with a broader range of crimes and called his sentence light. Human Rights Watch says Lubanga should have also been charged with further war crimes, including sexual violence, torture, and murder committed in the Ituri region of northeastern Democratic Republic of Congo. But the court said today that former prosecutor Luis Moreno Ocampo failed to prove those allegations. With credit for time served, Lubanga will spend a maximum of 8 more years behind bars. Joint UN Arab League envoy Kofi Annan was in Tehran today, meeting with Iran's foreign minister to seek cooperation in mediating an end to unabated violence in Syria. But Foreign Minister Ali Akbar Salahi told Al Jazeera that while no ruler is an eternal ruler,
in the case of Mr. Bashar Assad, by 2014, there is a presidential election which is coming up in 2014. We will have to let the events to take its normal course.
Annan's efforts to engage Iran in the discussion about Syria are outside of international talks involving the United States, which has refused to include Iran in earlier meetings. Yesterday, Annan met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and said they agreed on an approach to peace that Annan will pose to the opposition, who still call for Assad to step down. Assad had agreed to Annan's earlier peace plan, but never implemented it. According to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, more than 17,000 people have died in the 16-month-long uprising. Israel released Palestinian footballer Mahmoud al-Sarsak today, after detaining him for more than 3 years without charge. FSRN's Ghassan Banoura has more.
Mahmoud al-Sarsak arrived in the Gaza Strip in an ambulance and was greeted by friends and family. He had been jailed for more than 3 years under Israel's unlawful combatants law. In protest, Mahmoud went on hunger strike that lasted 91 days before Israeli authorities agreed to release him. Israel accused Mahmoud of being part of the armed wing of the Islamic Jihad, allegations he denied. Mahmoud followed the footsteps of Hana al-Shalabi and Khadr Adnan, who were released from Israeli military detention earlier this year. Al-Shalabi went on hunger strike for 44 days before her release, while Adnan's hunger strike lasted for 66 days. And according to the Palestinian Prisoner Society, another detainee, Akram al-Rikhawi, began his 93rd day of hunger strike today, demanding his immediate release. Ghassan Banoura, FSRN, Bethlehem.
Bahrain's Information Authority announced today that a court has ordered a political party to disband, saying the group is religiously based and instigates violence and hatred. Further, the order cited numerous violations of political rules. The Islamic Action Party has been active in Bahrain's pro-democracy movement since last February. And yesterday, a Bahraini court sentenced influential blogger and activist Nabil Rajab to 3 months in jail for slanderous tweets. Rajab was later removed from his home by security forces, some wearing balaclavas and others in riot gear. The Episcopal Church USA has officially cleared the way for transgender candidates for the clergy to be ordained. At their national meeting in Indianapolis yesterday, the church's full convention approved an anti-discrimination measure for both clergy candidates and church members. And the House of Bishops also approved an official service and blessing for same-sex Episcopalian couples, though the service is not the equivalent of marriage. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Washington, both chambers of Congress and multiple federal agencies are pushing for sweeping cybersecurity legislation that would allow more information sharing between corporations and the government. But privacy advocates say the country's intelligence gathering agency, the National Security Administration, already has too much access to U.S. citizens' private data and has abused its powers by engaging in widespread, warrantless domestic surveillance. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Many senators on both sides of the aisle are calling for the swift passage of a comprehensive cybersecurity bill, and Majority Leader Harry Reid plans to hold a vote before the end of the month. One vocal supporter is National Security Administration Director Keith Alexander. He said in a speech on Monday that the NSA needs more and better data access in order to protect American individuals and businesses from cyber attacks.
How do we share information between government departments? How do we share information between the government and industry? And how do we do that in such a way that the American people know that we're protecting their civil liberties and privacy?
The House passed the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, or CISPA, in April. The bill places no limits on the kind of data that can be shared and would override existing anti-wiretapping laws, companies' individual privacy rules, and the Electronic Privacy Act. If approved, CISPA would also block any Freedom of Information Act requests from consumers trying to find out who is sharing their personal data and with whom. During a Q&A with reporters, Alexander dismissed allegations that the agency already stores and fishes through trillions of private communications as misinformation, and said the NSA is only on the lookout for cyber threats.
They're not reading your email, per se, to see that. They're looking at the stream of data that's coming in hexadecimal format, looking for signatures or ports or different types of activity. And if they see that activity, they alert off of it.
Three former NSA officials claim otherwise and filed a motion last week supporting an ongoing lawsuit against the agency for what privacy advocates say is widespread mass illegal surveillance of ordinary people. That suit was filed by the Electronic Frontier Foundation on behalf of a group of concerned citizens. Attorney Lee Tien says it could force the NSA to disclose and justify what information they are collecting from Americans.
The essence of our complaints has been that this warrantless wiretapping program is a dragnet program, that it collects communications in an indiscriminate fashion so that they can be reviewed possibly at a later time. And we are asserting that the surveillance is continuing today and that it continues to be unconstitutional.
In his court briefing supporting the lawsuit, former NSA analyst William Binney said the agency has the capability to search through its massive stockpile of electronic communications for individual addresses, phone numbers, watchlisted names, keywords, and phrases, and he believes the agency is doing so. Binney, who resigned following the Bush administration's wiretapping program, also described the mentality of the NSA, saying that, quote, the civil liberties preserved in the U.S. Constitution were no longer a consideration after the September 11th attacks. These allegations have also caught the attention of lawmakers. Democrat Senators Ron Wyden and Mark Udall wrote to the NSA last summer asking how the agency interprets current national security law, approximately how many people in the U.S. have their communications reviewed, and how many of those people are, quote, law-abiding U.S. citizens. Despite serving on the Senate Intelligence Committee, the senators have no access to this information. Last month, the agency responded by refusing to answer, saying doing so would, quote, violate the privacy of U.S. persons. Tian says this case is a perfect example of a growing trend, where the government knows more than ever about its citizens, but citizens know less than ever about their government.
We hope that we'll be able to hold the government accountable for what it's done, or at least get the government to be much more forthcoming about what it has done in the name of national security.
The NSA initially got the lawsuit dismissed by invoking the state secrets privilege, saying even letting the challenge go forward would endanger the country. But the Ninth Circuit Court rejected that argument, and the U.S. District Court will hear the case in November. The Electronic Frontier Foundation is also pursuing a parallel case against AT&T for turning over the private data to the NSA. According to documents released Monday by Massachusetts Democrat Ed Markey, U.S. law enforcement made more than 1 million requests last year to the nation's major telecommunications companies, seeking access to consumers' geolocation information, text messages, and phone calls. Alice Holstein, FSRN, Washington.
Across the U.S., hunger strikes in response to solitary confinement have been spreading. In California, Virginia, Ohio, and Colorado, prisoners are engaging in strikes to draw attention to the practice. The protests, along with condemnation from human rights groups, have made an impact. In June, the U.S. Senate held the first ever congressional hearing on the psychological and human rights implications of solitary confinement, noting that the U.S. holds more people in isolation than any other democratic country in the world. From Atlanta, FSRN's Asaki Hall reports on one of the latest hunger strikes.
In December 2010, prisoners across Georgia held a work strike reported to be the largest in U.S. history. 18 months later, a hunger strike is underway in Georgia's Jackson State Prison, where perceived leaders of the 2010 strike have been held in solitary confinement. 10 confirmed prisoners, some of whom were involved in the 2010 work strike, have refused food for a month. Their demands include access to proper hygiene, medical treatment of injuries, restoration of family visitations and communication rights, and access to personal property. Delma Jackson, the wife of one of the hunger strikers, Miguel Jackson, says the Department of Corrections is violating its own standard operating procedures.
My husband, he's been held in maximum security prison under 24-hour lockdown. He's supposed to have an hour a day, but he has not been outside since March of this year.
Jackson said her husband was severely beaten by prison guards following the 2010 prison work strike and has been in solitary confinement since. He also has not been given proper medical treatment in the 18 months of isolation. Additionally, Jackson says other rights are being denied, including access to their commissary and the 30-day status review every inmate in punitive isolation is supposed to receive. Another advocate is Hugh Esco, who works with the Georgia Green Party and has been involved in prisoner solidarity work since the December 2010 strike. He says the conditions the prisoners face violate human rights standards, particularly the long periods of solitary confinement.
In the international community, they talk about 15 days of solitary confinement bordering on torture. And if 15 days is torture, what is 18 months? What is 10 years? One of these hunger strikers apparently has been locked down for 10 years now.
On Monday, supporters and family members of the strikers delivered letters to Georgia Governor Nathan Deal at the state capitol, urging him to intervene. Delma Jackson rallied the support of the crowd, urging people outside of the prison to support those inside.
These men are human, and they have families that love them. We cannot, I say that again, we cannot, and we will not turn a blind eye to this any longer.
Next week, supporters of the family members will deliver demands to Brian Owens, Georgia's Department of Correction Commissioner. Prisoners are continuing their protests, too, and hunger strikes are reportedly spreading to other prisons in Georgia. FSRN, Sacagawea Hall, Atlanta.
Today in Egypt, the parliament met briefly in Cairo in defiance of the military council that dissolved the body last month. The move came at the request of newly elected President Mohamed Morsi and sets up a power struggle among civilian leaders, the high court, and military rulers. For more, we're joined by FSRN reporter Noelle King in Cairo. She's on mobile phone. Hi, Noelle.
Hi there.
So what happened today at the parliament? What was the order of business?
Well, first of all, there was no attempt by the Egyptian authorities to physically stand in the way of the parliament members as they entered the building. The session only lasted for about 15 minutes, and that was just long enough for the members of parliament who had shown up to to approve a motion from the Speaker, Saad Katatni. Mr. Katatni was deferential toward the High Constitutional Court. He said, "We're not trying to subvert your ruling. We're just trying to understand how best to implement it. So we're referring this whole matter to an appeals court." Now, what that does on one hand is it ratchets down the pressure a little bit and buys everyone in Egypt a bit more time. But on the other hand, it only strengthens the appearance that Egypt right now is a country that's in a state of complete judicial and legal disarray.
And at the session, not all MPs were in attendance. Who was missing?
You know, Egypt's liberal and left MPs were not too thrilled by Mohamed Morsi's decision to reconvene the parliament, and here's why. Egypt was run by strongmen for 60 years, the kind of men who threw court decisions out the window all the time. When Egyptians went out to the polls and elected a president, what they were going for was democracy. So while in some quarters Mr. Morsi's move is considered, you know, it has been greeted warmly and is even considered heroic, in others this smacks to his critics in particular, not as the move of a democratic statesman, but as the move of somebody who's engaging in the same sort of authoritarian behavior by turning his nose up at the country's high court and saying, "I don't have to listen to you." It reminds people of the Mubarak era.
Well, and this move by President Morsi and the parliament being reconvened, coming just about more than a week after he was sworn into office. Much was made of President Morsi's attendance at a military function Monday, where he sat next to Field Marshal Mohamed Tantawi of the Military Council. What does this say about the relationship between newly elected President Morsi and the Military Council?
You know, that was a really interesting moment, a moment that was shown on Egyptian state television for everyone to see. These are two men who are supposed to be, alleged to be, at each other's throats politically. But throughout the course of this ceremony, which was a graduation for military cadets, the two men chatted to each other, they smiled a couple of times. They certainly didn't look like two guys who were about to face off in a political confrontation, either in public or behind closed doors. Now, on the other hand, as I say, this was a public graduation ceremony, and there's a good chance that both of them were behaving because they were in public, and it would have been no excuse for them to go after each other at a graduation.
And as this situation evolves and moves forward, are there any plans for the parliament to meet again? There's the issue of drafting a constitution that's supposed to be taking place in the near future. What's next in this?
Those are great questions, and it's important to distinguish between the parliament and the constituent assembly, the group of people who are writing the new constitution. What the parliament speaker said today is that the body is not going to meet again until this appeals court, who is hearing the matter, hands down a decision or gives them some legal advice on how the members of parliament should proceed. So in the meantime, they will all stay home. The constituent assembly, on the other hand, which was appointed by the parliament, continues to meet and continues to work on drafting the Egyptian constitution. What happens if the constituent assembly does come up with a constitution and then Egypt's Supreme Court turns around and says, constituent assembly, the 100-member body writing this document, isn't legitimate? That's the kind of judicial and legal power plays and struggles you see going on right now. It's got everyone really confused.
Well, as this moves forward, you did mention some of the groups who came out critical of President Morsi for this move of reconvening the parliament. How about the reaction in the streets? Has there been any protests or rallies?
There have been marches both in support of President Morsi and in support of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces ruling generals. These marches, though, and protests have been fairly small, numbering in the low thousands, and fairly self-contained. Today, Muslim Brotherhood, on behalf of Morsi, called for a million-man march in Tahrir Square. They do these pretty frequently, once every couple of weeks at this point. As dusk has fallen and the temperatures are cooling down a little bit, we are seeing more people turn out in Tahrir Square, but nothing more than a few hundred, and certainly nothing like the numbers that the Muslim Brotherhood would have been hoping for.
That's FSRN reporter Noel King in Cairo. Thanks, Noel.
Thank you.
With 200 contributing reporters on six continents, Free Speech Radio News brings you the news from many corners of the world.
Екатерина Данилова, FSRN, St. Petersburg, Russia.
Sam Lukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
Qassam Bannoura, FSRN, Bethlehem.
Khaled Sid Mohand, Free Speech Radio News, Paris.
Madonna Virola, FSRN, Calapan City, Philippines.
While many newsrooms have closed their bureaus overseas, FSRN's network of reporters living in the communities they cover enables us to bring you international coverage each and every weekday. International grassroots reporting that is indispensable and irreplaceable. Support FSRN and our global coverage by visiting our website, fsrn.org. In Turkey, nearly 200 people, including academics, students, activists, and journalists, are on trial for terrorism charges. The parliament abolished a special court system where these defendants are being tried, but the existing trials are moving forward, and critics say the courts are being used to stifle dissent. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports.
About 40 miles north of Istanbul is Silivri Prison and Courthouse, where dozens of defendants are on trial for aiding a banned Kurdish organization. Several hundred people are gathered here in support of the accused. A nearby white van defiantly blasts Kurdish music as prisoners traveling in a police convoy flash the V Victory sign to the protesters. Prosecutors say the 193 people on trial supported the Union of Communities in Kurdistan, a group they say is linked to the militant Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK. Turkey, the United States, and the European Union consider PKK a terrorist organization. Among the accused is publisher Recep Zorakoğlu, who was recently nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. He's among a group of academics and journalists swept up in a raid of the offices of a pro-Kurdish political party. Alexis Krikorian of the Geneva-based International Publishers Association is observing the trial.
Turkey is a very interesting example because as far as we know, this is one of the rare countries where actually publishers go on trial or even in prison sometimes on freedom of expression grounds.
Human rights advocates decry the number of Turkish journalists arrested. These arrests, detentions, and trials are also having a chilling effect, says Earl Underalo of Reporters Without Borders.
It can push to self-censorship. It can restrict relationship from a very ordinary academic activity. It's not something who have a good repercussion on free journalism and free academic activity.
The special court trial linking academics, journalists, and publishers to Kurdish militants is just one of several underway. The highest profile indictment involves top-ranking generals accused of a coup plot. The military officers have been under arrest since 2008, but journalists who have reported critically on the process have also been swept up in the dragnet. Last fall, about a dozen reporters were indicted for allegedly skewing their news coverage in a biased way. For the past 16 months, Barış Pehlivan, editor of O.TV, has been in pretrial detention.
There's no press freedom in Turkey anymore, and that is really hurtful.
That's Pelevin's wife, Özge Türkoğlu.
I remember Barış before he got arrested, saying me that, okay, you see that, you know, this is happening to people that are sometimes writing the truth in Turkey, but as you can see, I'm just doing my job, and if one day this is going to cost me my freedom, I cannot just stop writing. That was what he was saying, and it actually did happen.
Earlier this month, the Turkish parliament passed a law ending the special courts, but the legislation will not halt the trials already underway. And Eugene Shulgin, vice president of the writers' advocacy group PEN International, is skeptical it will make much difference.
The fact that parliament has declared these extraordinary trials for illegal is a very good sign. But it remains to be seen what will happen in reality, because this is a country where good intentions does not count. The doing is what counts.
As the trials continue this week, hundreds of protesters continue to keep vigil outside the courthouse as riot police stand by. There is no definite timetable for these trials, and defendants often wait months between hearings. Some of them face 15 years in prison if found guilty. Defense lawyers say the government's strategy may be to use this week's trial to ban the pro-Kurdish Peace and Democracy Party. It's happened many times before, most recently in 2009. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Silivri, Turkey.
Before we end today, a clarification to our story last week on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade deal that is the center of talks taking place this week in San Diego. In that story, we said that corporate lobbyists have access to the draft negotiations of the trade deal. After we aired the story, the U.S. Trade Representative's office contacted us, taking issue with the term lobbyists because the corporate leaders aren't officially registered lobbyists. To shed some light on the issue, I'm joined now by FSRN DC correspondent Alice Olstein. Hi, Alice.
Hello, Dorian.
Tell us a little more about what the Office of U.S. Trade Representative said.
Well, the spokesperson said that the corporate leaders that have access to the draft negotiations of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, those people are representatives, not lobbyists. They're not lobbyists because they don't meet the federal definition of a lobbyist and are not federally registered as lobbyists. And in a statement written to FSRN, the office emphasized that the Obama administration actually barred lobbyists from serving on these committees 3 years ago.
So who are these representatives that have access to the draft of the Trans-Pacific trade deal?
That information is publicly available on the U.S. Trade Representative's website, and it shows that serving on these advisory committees are high-level executives of many major corporations, including FedEx, SC Johnson & Company, and industry groups such as the National Pork Producers Council and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. But unions, environmental groups, academic groups, think tanks, they also have representatives on these advisory committees, including the United Steelworkers, the Environmental Defense Fund, and the National Small Business Association. So the public interest groups that are tracking these Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations, they say that all of these committee members are lobbying for their respective industries or interests or causes. So in our report, we use the term lobby and lobbyist in the general dictionary definition sense of the word. But the U.S. Trade Representative's office wanted to make sure our listeners knew that they're not federally registered lobbyists.
Thanks, Alice.
All right. Thanks so much. You're welcome.
That's FSRN's D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Washington, D.C. intern is Neth Smith-Savadoff. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments at FSRN.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, FSRN.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FSRN. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.